Joe Clement leads off today's program talking with local anti-fascist scholar and activist Shane Burley about stochastic terrorism and the connection between seemingly random acts of lone wolf white supremacist violence and right-wing public figures. They then connect that to the current Republican effort to criminalize Antifa and the upcoming Proud Boy rally on 8/17, which states as its alleged purpose the ending of a domestic terrorism, but is actually a blatant attempt, along with their Republican allies, to have an Antifa alone designated as domestic terrorists. Joe?
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The recent mass shooting in El Paso, Texas, by a Trump-supporting white supremacist, complete with racist manifesto, has been diagnosed in the media and by Trump himself as mental illness. These characterizations, though, can mystify the political dynamics of the shooter's decision to commit mass murder, because they redirect our attention from the socially constructed motivations of the shooter to the pathological characteristics of the shooter as an individual with an apparently faulty brain. Not only does this lead to harm by furthering stereotypes against those with mental illnesses, but it obscures frightening trends in public and political discourse that are actually driving these actions. My guest today is Shane Burley, local author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It, and of an article that just appeared in truthout.org, The Right Wing is Trying to Make It a Crime to Oppose Fascism. He's going to talk with me today about a term called stochastic terrorism that's been gaining currency in the media for trying to illuminate the connection between the violent rhetoric of right-wing public figures and the seemingly random acts of gun violence by white male supremacists. We're going to try to then connect that to a set of other frightening developments, namely the Republican effort by Ted Cruz to criminalize Antifa and label it as a terrorist organization, and the upcoming Proud Boy rally on the 17th that calls for an end to domestic terrorism, meaning Antifa. I wanted to start off by talking about this term stochastic terrorism with you, because every time this has happened for the last few years, it's been the same narrative of, oh, you know, he had problems, he was just so normal, why didn't we see this coming? What is happening in America that is causing men to shoot up people, and how does stochastic terrorism help us try to explain it?
Yeah, there's a real tendency to assume that everything to do with a mass shooting is individualized. That's how we deal with it in law enforcement, and in a lot of ways that's how we talk about things in the media, but it basically belies the fact that there's underlying ideologies and influences that are at play. So the term that you're talking about, we're talking about the influence that larger media personalities, particularly right-wing talk radio and cable news type folks, podcasters, right-wing websites, what effect they have on people. And the effect is like drumming up a real climate of fear around the left, around immigration, around conspiracy theories like white genocide, and this idea that white men are losing ground in some really critical way. And so the message that is sent on these various issues is one that's apocalyptic, that this is the end of days if we don't deal with it. And what that does is creates a climate where lone wolves have to emerge, where certain people in that population feel as though they are going to be responsible for fixing the crisis, and they have to do that through extreme action because all other action has already failed. And so when you see someone like Trump, allowing chants like send her back or laughing along when people are talking about shooting immigrants, that sends a very clear message that that is where the Overton window is. That's where acceptable political discourse and action is. And it sends a certain message to parts of that fringe that then they need to take action, that that kind of action is justified and that they're on the right side to do it. And this is historically something that's played into a large portion of terrorist actions, whether we're talking about domestically in things like the militia movement of the 90s, that was really stoked by a lot of right-wing publications, you know, anti-tax and anti-federal government publications, or in all around the world, when you see really large genocidal uprisings, there's a lot of narrative chatter that happens from media outlets that want to stoke that anger, either for cynical purposes or for sincere ones, but either way, it's meant to stoke a real violent anger that then parts of the audience will use to take out violent action.
And whereas I think a lot of our ideas about terrorists assume some sort of organized effort, you know, these lone wolves, as they're called, seem to have no connection usually to a formal fascist or white supremacist organization that is helping them along, but they are connected to the world of white supremacists and fascists through the internet, through other kinds of communities where they are exchanging these ideas and they're listening to them through the media.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, generally what you find is that when someone takes a lone wolf action, they've done it separate from the white nationalist organization. Even if they were a part of those groups, they tend to step out on their own. So the group has influenced their thinking and it's created an apocalyptic thinking in them, but then they step out on their own to do it. It doesn't mean that the group isn't responsible. It just means that the group didn't have their hand on that person at every point in time. But this is especially true right now because white nationalist organizations, and I mean formal organizations like the KKK or neo-Nazi parties, those have really declined, just like in a lot of ways all political organizations have declined in a world of a more like larger multitude. People exist in social networks and they relate to politics in much different ways. And so you'll see a larger portion of people who maybe never had an association with the white nationalist movement formally, and maybe they never even met another white nationalist in person, but they're very much tied to white nationalist thinking, rhetoric, and the spaces, the virtual spaces where they go into and they get those ideas reinforced. So they're very much influenced by white nationalism, including organized white nationalism, even if they never set foot in one of those organizations' meetings.
If there is a decline of organizations, of political organizations, obviously they pose a danger to the people that they kill, but if they're just individuals, why is that not a sign, perhaps, of the weakening rather than an omen of it getting worse?
I mean, it's both. So on the one side, when formal fascist organizations and social movements start to decline, that's usually when lone wolf violence begins to happen. It's usually when they've been trying for a very long time, they thought they were going to have success using a mass movement approach. It starts to fail, and then they go underground. People, the fringe of that already fringe, start to take action in desperate ways and impulsive ways because the planned course of action didn't work out. So in a lot of ways, the decline of that larger mass movement results in the violence. The thing that I think we should be really concerned about is that this violence is becoming much larger and faster than it has in a lot of previous years. And part of that's because of the degree of the size of the alt-right and then its subsequent period of decline. And then also the increased radicalization online is much more profound than it was in years past when it took many, many years for someone to interact with the white nationalist movement to get those ideas and to make that radical shift. The other thing is that we have much larger pulpits pumping out anti-immigrant hate constantly. You know, we have major websites, we have the President of the United States validating it, and it's happening all the time. And at the same time, we're also in an increased period of social crisis, climate change, people just seeing demographic change and white people are reacting with white supremacist racism. And there's all kinds of things that are happening that's creating a really toxic climate that's sending a message to people who are already living on the fringe that this is acceptable course of action and this is the way forward.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking with Shane Burley, author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It, about stochastic terrorism and the right-wing nationalist movements that are coming to Portland later this week. So I wanted to return to that term stochastic terrorism. Just what exactly is it referring to?
Was acts of terrorism that are influenced by the demonization of a group, usually through a media outlet, an outside, a third party's kind of focus on that particular group that ends up leading to terrorist violence, even in ways that they maybe not didn't predict or that we couldn't predict directly. So, for example, if someone like Donald Trump spends 2 years demonizing immigrants and then people go out and start attacking immigrants, I think this concept really hails back to what responsibility he and people like him have in that violence.
So the word stochastic...
It's when something's probable and remains unpredictable. And so we know the relationship between stoking that anger through media portrayals, particularly the demonization of minority groups, and what violence it results. But it's next to impossible to be able to chart it in a way that we can present it other than confronting that rhetoric directly.
This is useful to bring into our conversations just because of how much plausible deniability goes into the way that the media and the politicians relate to these events.
Yeah, absolutely. When drawing this picture of the world together, it sends a very clear narrative message to people about who they should blame and what they need to do about it. They need to make dramatic actions, ones that targets those people as much as possible. And so even if someone like Tucker Carlson on Fox News or places like Breitbart try and use plausible deniability, oh, we're not directly informing that kind of violence. We don't argue for it. We're anti-violence, things like that. They're setting up the conditions in which violence is the only logical conclusion.
And that brings me around to the criminalization of Antifa, and Ted Cruz has put forward a resolution that would not really probably do a whole lot other than try to build this legal bridge to defining Antifa as a terrorist organization. Could you say a bit about what that effort is and what it is banking on in terms of misunderstandings about Antifa?
Yeah, Ted Cruz introduced a Senate resolution to declare Antifa, however he defines that, as a domestic terrorist organization. There's a lot of problems with this. The first of which is that, you know, a non-binding Senate resolution doesn't lead necessarily to a law. Antifa is poorly defined. It mentions both anti-ICE organizations in there, as well as Rose City Antifa, which is an anti-fascist organization in Portland. Those two aren't synonymous. There's a really broad use of the definition Antifa to mean almost anything that's left-wing or anything that's anti-racist in some way, and then also used as a default for what they think is violent protest activity. Antifa does not mean a specific organization. It doesn't mean a broad-based movement. It doesn't mean individual certain strategies or tactics. It means a whole range of them. And so by having that broad definition and naming that terrorist, it has the effect of essentially sweeping all organizations under the rug into this terrorism banner. And so while that doesn't necessarily create a category, because there is no legal category of domestic terrorist organization, it does have the effect, as particularly when it's echoed by Donald Trump, to send a message to federal investigators, to local police, to crack down, to increase investigations, perhaps to do RICO charges, to try and say that there's a criminal conspiracy, to basically increase state repression on such an extreme level that it's going to crush any form of dissent and have a chilling effect.
And then you have the rally that's coming up, where the main theme of it is ending domestic terrorism. And it seems very clear that Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys are very cognizant of these discursive strategies and are trying to, like, really bring them home for people to flesh out this fear that Antifa is an organization and that it has to be treated as one that's doing bad things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so there's a big rally on August 17th where a lot of right-wing people are coming in to confront what they call domestic terrorism. What they mean is Antifa and left-wing groups. This came after a recent anti-fascist demonstration where a right-wing live streamer and editor of the right-wing publication Colette, Andy Ngo, had a conflict with some protesters. The narrative was then drummed up that somehow Antifa, however they define it, again, it was attacking journalists, particularly Andy Ngo, and that it wasn't simply just a conflict between, you know, a group of people. And because of that, and because of the right-wing media sphere just amping this message up, the idea that Antifa is responsible for terrorism, which is just factually untrue, has created this impetus for them to come in here and essentially promise violence. And that's what's happening. They're responding to this image, this this group is actually responsible for terrorist violence, even though they've killed no one in comparison to the white nationalists who have killed hundreds of people in the last several years. And so they're going to respond with an extreme level of anger and vitriol. And that almost promises that people will get hurt, despite the fact that none of the left-wing people want them to come here and don't want to engage in that. And so I think it's a real falsehood, and it's been created to drum up that kind of anger.
Yeah, it's very Orwellian the way that they are taking a reality like the fact that the majority of domestic terrorism in this country in the last several years has been committed by white supremacists, and flipping that into just this surreal non-reality, which is that Antifa is doing horrible things. They've not killed anybody, and the worst that they can say is that they've clobbered some guy pretending to be a journalist.
And by drumming up this fear, it led a lot of journalists to be targeted by the far right for threats and trolling and real vicious behavior by trying to associate them with an imaginary terrorist threat that's simply not there.
So there are a lot of people who still today, even on KABU, if you listen to some programs that take up the question of Antifa, are not sure whether Antifa or certain tactics that seem associated with Antifa help or not. And there's, you know, concern that they just make things worse. Why should people still be showing up and not hiding the fact that we are opposing fascism?
I think that anti-fascism is a mass movement that of people participating in a variety of ways to show opposition to something that I think is pretty frightening universally. This idea that anti-fascism can be reduced to just some individual's particular behavior is factually wrong. But I think the other thing that's important to note is that anti-fascism has worked. The alt-right has declined, in their own words, because of anti-fascist organizing. Anti-fascist organizing is a real tradition of confronting white national violence and preventing it from taking place. And I think that's actually verifiable. And so I know what the assumption is, that, you know, if if anti-fascist protesters look scary in the media or frighten some people, that that could do a disservice because it changes the perception of it, and that is kind of what can turn the tides on whether or not the movement is successful. But I think that actually misreads the history of social movements. What makes social movements successful is whether or not they organize successfully, not just how they play to really, really broad audiences that have no stake in it. And so I think what's really important is to look at what's the goal of anti-fascist organizing? Is that something you agree with? And how can you participate to make it successful in ways that you'd be proud of?
Well, thank you, Shane Burley, for coming on and trying to bring some clarity to these very chaotic and scary issues.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm always happy to come back.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking with Shane Burley, author of Fascism Today, How to End It, about stochastic terrorism and the attempt to criminalize anti-fascists.